Longtime media reform advocate Robert McChesney has led the fight against media consolidation. In his latest book, Digital Democracy, he looks at how capitalism is affecting democracy and journalism. On today's Friday Media Roundtable, we'll spend the hour with Robert McChesney discussing the economics of journalism, new media ventures funded by billionaire tech CEOs, media reform, and coverage of the ongoing revelations about the NSA's spying program. Where are we going from here, and what's the best way for you to get active? Join us after the news.
BBC News, I'm John Shea. China says it has scrambled fighter jets to trail American and Japanese military aircraft that entered its newly declared air defence zone. Beijing unilaterally declared the zone, which includes airspace over islands in the East China Sea that are claimed by China but controlled by Japan. From Beijing, here's Martin Patience.
China's state-run news agency says that Beijing scrambled fighter jets to monitor two US spy planes and 10 Japanese aircraft. The report gave no further details. On Thursday, Beijing said it was carrying out patrols in its new air defense zone in line with international norms. The announcement followed a show of defiance by the US, South Korea and Japan, who all flew military aircraft through the zone. They're refusing to inform China of their flight plans, as Beijing is now demanding.
At the end of a summit in Lithuania, European Union leaders have warned they will not tolerate Russian interference in their negotiations on closer integration with Ukraine. From the Lithuanian capital Vilnius, Chris Morris sent this report.
Signing an agreement with Ukraine was supposed to be the centrepiece of this EU summit, a deal which could have transformed one of Europe's largest countries and given it full access to much of the EU single market. But under massive pressure from Russia, including the threat of substantial trade sanctions, the Ukrainian president, Viktor Yanukovych, refused to sign. The EU says the door is still open for Ukraine, but Mr. Yanukovych wanted Russia directly involved in any further talks. The president of the European Commission, José Manuel Barroso, said the EU could not accept any kind of Russian veto.
Prosecutors in London have been spelling out the gruesome details of the killing last May of a British soldier, Lee Rigby, close to his London barracks. Michael Adebowale and Michael Adebolajo deny the charges. Sarah Jones was in court.
Inside the courtroom, the two defendants sat in a glass dock. The lead prosecutor, Richard Whittam, QC, began his opening address, which included some rather distressing evidence. He said the men drove a car straight at Fusilier Rigby, it hit him and knocked him unconscious. The jury heard how Lee Rigby was repeatedly stabbed and Michael Adebolajo made a serious and almost successful attempt to decapitate him. The court was shown a video of Michael Adebolajo making a speech at the time of the attack. In it, he said, "The only reason we have killed this man today is because Muslims are dying daily by British soldiers."
Police in Egypt have fired tear gas at hundreds of Islamist protesters who were defying a new law that bans unauthorised demonstrations. There were clashes in Cairo and Alexandria as the protesters came out onto the streets in response to calls from the Muslim Brotherhood. World News from the BBC. The president of the Democratic Republic of Congo, Joseph Kabila, has driven into Rutshuru, a former stronghold of the M23 rebels. He set off 9 days ago by car from the northeastern city of Kisangani. Maud Julien is in eastern Congo.
The president hasn't been in the east of the country for over 2 years now, and it was very important for him at this point, now that the M23 rebels have been defeated almost a month ago, to show that state authority is being restored in these areas. People in his convoy actually told me he was driving himself in very dangerous areas, so the message he's trying to convey is clearly that there's no part of the national territory that he doesn't control.
The French Parliament is debating a bill aimed at reducing prostitution by imposing heavy fines on people caught paying for sex. Prostitution is legal in France, but brothels, pimping and soliciting in public are not. Here's Christian Fraser.
If it is passed, this cross-party bill will transfer criminality from the prostitute to the client, with the introduction of €1,500 fines for those who are caught. The fine will be doubled if the client is caught twice. Those arrested will also be forced to attend re-education classes. For prostitutes who agree to give up the game, there'll be work permits, free housing and almost €400 a month in benefits.
The official data watchdog in the Netherlands says that Google has been breaking the country's data privacy laws. The company implemented a new policy last year allowing it to collate information gathered about people who used more than one of its many services. The Dutch Data Protection Authority said that Google's policy did not do enough to specify what it was collecting data for. A leading campaigner for giving women the right to drive in Saudi Arabia has been stopped by police as she was driving through the capital, Riyadh. Aziza Al-Youssef told the BBC she was taken to a police station where she was asked to sign a pledge not to drive. And that's the latest BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we're spending the hour with longtime media reform advocate Robert McChesney. As co-founder of the organization Free Press, Bob has led the battle against media consolidation. He and John Nichols, the Washington, D.C. correspondent for The Nation, have co-authored a new book called Dollarocracy: How the Money and Media Election Campaign is Destroying America. Over the past 7 weeks, they've done 45 events across the country, and we'll be talking with Bob about those events and what he's hearing from citizens. Bob also authored Digital Disconnect: How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. In that book, he argues that the future of American politics could be largely determined by who controls the internet. Robert McChesney is professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the show.
A pleasure to be here, Rose.
It's great to have you. And we're really happy to have you on for the whole hour to talk about the overall state of the media and what's been happening the last couple months. But we usually start on Fridays by giving kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week, because we think it's important to highlight good work because there's so much out there. So what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, boy, you know, I was asked to look for something and come up with something smart to say in response to that. I confess I've been so busy I didn't have a chance to scope out anything. So what I've seen that is good is probably something that's been on your show several other times, which is Glenn Greenwald's coverage of the NSA scandal, of the revelations and what they mean, and sort of use deep probing behind the official rhetoric and official defenses to look at really what's going on and why it's so alarming for a free society.
So can you talk overall just about what your thoughts are on the reporting on the NSA leaks? I mean, every day something new comes out. I mean, we're now learning that the U.S. has monitored the calls of 35 world leaders and possibly even the Pope.
In my book, Digital Disconnect, which came out in February of this year, which I finished writing last fall, one of the things that's striking, if you read it now, is that pretty much everything that Snowden cables revealed and that Glenn Greenwald's been writing about was sitting there. I mean, I said this is what's going on, based really on business reports, government reports, material that was in the public domain and easy to find. And I just put it out in passing that there's this tight cooperation between the national security agencies and the largest media internet companies like Google and Apple and Amazon and Facebook. And there's tremendous cooperation going on. And pretty much everything we do online, they know, and they track and they monitor, and they have this capability, and they're using it. So I put it out there in the book. And what was striking to me at the time and where I proceeded with that in the book was saying, why isn't this a news story? Why isn't this being covered? This is really the lowest hanging fruit out there for American journalism. This is not a difficult story. It's been there really for much of the previous decade prior to Snowden and Glenn Greenwald. Why wasn't this a huge story? And, you know, I talk about specifically the WikiLeaks revelations that came a year or so before the NSA revelations, which were similar, though, in scope, and had some of the same material, and discussed why those weren't covered. Because it really was the great news story is, why wasn't this a news story when it was sitting there, the lowest hanging fruit, the greatest story out there for political journalists, this massive illegal spying going on? And, you know, I think the problem traditionally has been for the last decade is that our political journalism, as a rule, takes its cues by what people in power are debating. If they're having a feisty debate about something, and they want to cover it, then journalists have a lot of room to go about and quote both sides and do some digging and challenge their sources. But when people in power, both leaders of the Republican and Democratic Party, are in agreement on an issue, it's very difficult for our political journalists, if not impossible, for them to challenge that consensus without being accused of being unprofessional, ideological. And I think NSA spying pretty much fell into that camp. No one in power really was that upset about it. This is a bipartisan effort. It's been going on for a long time. It's part of the whole military-industrial complex. It's just taken for granted as a given as something that America does. And the less we talk about it, the less people know about it, the better. And our journalists followed those cues. And it's striking, Rose, that the story was broken by someone who's now being hunted by the American government and by a newspaper that's based in Britain, not the United States. So that's the backstory. That's the most important story, why stories like this don't get covered. Since the revelations have been published, since the reporting's been done by Glenn Greenwald, you know, I think we've seen largely in the United States weak reporting, that they've basically been concerned with what people in power do, how they respond to it, rather than the content of the cables and sort of the fundamental questions it raises, with notable exceptions. And there have been cues, fortunately, for some of our better reporters, the remaining reporters we have, to cover the story. But on balance, I think this is one of the most disgraceful episodes in the history of American journalism. Mm.
Well, and it's interesting to see that still media outlets are conducting these polls. Is Snowden a traitor or a hero? I mean, what are your thoughts about where this is going? And why do you think that, you know, there, with so much information we have, like you mentioned in your book about all of these technology companies, that it hasn't been really explored until now?
Well, again, it's the political consensus on one hand that both parties are in bed with this process, and so this is simply not going to be raised. And the historical comparison would be going back to the 1960s and early 1970s when the federal government and the FBI and the police departments engaged in what's called COINTELPRO, counterintelligence program, in which the federal government was, Hoover and that crowd, J. Edgar Hoover, were deeply concerned about the new left, about the civil rights movement, the black power movement, any sort of opposition to the status quo. And they infiltrated these movements. They spied on them illegally. We now know that usually the most radical person in every dissident group of that period, the one calling for sort of violent action, was usually a government agent. They were trying to, what they hated most was nonviolent protests because they knew that was very powerful. And they tried to convince people to do illegal acts so they could then brand them as terrorists. And this is sort of standard and par for the course, but it wasn't a news story then. It really, you know, even though that was going on and everyone sort of knew it beneath the surface, it wasn't a news story. It became a news story, government harassment of political groups and political parties, when the government harassed, the Nixon administration harassed the Democrats. Then suddenly that's a real news story during Watergate. That was sort of stepping over the line. You could go ahead and mess with, you know, civil rights groups and peace groups and all sorts of organizations that were on the margins. But once you went after someone in power, that was unacceptable. And our news media with Watergate as a result. And I think there's an element of that here. Now, the other point, though, and the one that's crucial that you raised, Rose, is that, you know, we have at the Internet now, the dominant companies today, Google, Apple, Amazon, AT&T, Verizon, Comcast, these companies are enormous powerhouses. They all rank among the 20 or 30 most valuable companies in the U.S. economy. They're enormous companies. By economic standards, they're all monopolies. They have tremendous market power, and they have tremendous political influence. So that only makes it more bulletproof, the sort of spying progress, because these companies are companies that journalists are loathe to criticize, especially the Internet companies, who are treated like, you know, they're sort of saints that have walked across the ocean on their feet to make our lives so much better. And whatever tens of billions of dollars of monopoly profits they make, they deserve. And so I think our journalists have traditionally been loathe to be critical of these organizations, which only makes it that much more difficult to get to the bottom of the spying scandal.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because the majority of the reporting on these corporations seems to focus on their profits. And just recently, Facebook surpassed Wall Street expectations, and a new study came out that found, for the first time ever, the top 10 CEOs in the U.S. took home at least $100 million. Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, is at the very top of that list. He took home, and this is really hard to comprehend, but $2.2 billion last year. But it's very rare to hear or to read in-depth stories about what companies like Facebook is doing with our private information. Why is that?
Well, it's sort of the problem built into the way our journalism has evolved or devolved in the past generation or two. You know, there was a time, and this is going to be stunning to, I think, your listeners, 50 or 60 years ago, when there was something called a labor reporter. And even the most conservative daily newspapers would have one or two or three labor reporters and editors, depending upon the size. And their job was to cover the quality of life for working class people and their economic fortunes and labor unions and the labor relations with management, oftentimes from the perspective of labor unions, not just from the perspective of management. And that whole group of reporters, and there were by some counts as many as 500 to 1,000 full-time labor reporters and editors in daily newspapers in 1950, that whole group has been eliminated and was pretty much gone by 1980 or 1990. And what's happened conversely is that as we saw the end of labor coverage, the end of any coverage of the economy from the perspective of people who weren't at the very top, we saw the increase in what's called business reporting. And now business reporting, the view of covering the economy from the perspective of Mark Zuckerberg and wealthy investors and high-end consumers, has replaced it. And it's become really a lion's share of what's called economic reporting today is so-called business reporting. And it's built into it the bias that the people who make lots of money are by definition contributing a great deal to society and justify getting their money. And it tends to be hagiography. You know, one of the great scandals of American journalism in the last 15 years, going back to the mid-90s and forward, was they had this huge burst in business reporting, the business sections in newspaper, business channels on TV, business publications that were blossoming. And for all the reporting we had on business, they completely missed every major economic scandal, the Enron scandal, all those corporate scandals of the late 90s and early zeros. They completely missed. They slept through the financial meltdown and financial crisis. They were too busy sort of cheering on bubbles and markets. And so it's really deplorable journalism as a rule. And we still have that culture today. I mean, if you pick up the business pages, they're falling all over themselves, congratulating large monopolistic firms for making extraordinary profits, for CEOs making, frankly, what I would consider obscene incomes. And there's not a critical word to be found. And it's because of that, the last place one would ever look to learn about how capitalism is actually functioning in our society is the business section of a newspaper.
Mm. Talking about money and journalism, what do you think about Glenn Greenwald's new news venture that has the backing of $250 million from eBay's billionaire Pierre Omidyar?
Well, on one hand, I'm delighted Glenn's got this money, that there's resources going to do the sort of journalism Glenn Greenwald does, that Jeremy Scahill does. I think that's tremendous, and Pierre Omidyar is to be congratulated for his willingness to do this, and let's hope he stays with it, because it is fantastic. So I think at that level, I'm delighted. But at the other level, I'm a little concerned with the sort of the analysis that goes along the lines of, well, this is the solution to our problems. We just have to find good billionaires to counter the bad billionaires. And the reason this is a concern is I think this is deep-seated in American sort of thinking about the journalism crisis, is that the solution has to come from the benevolence of billionaires to bankroll, since the market has already made it clear it's no longer interested in supporting journalism, digital journalism in particular. We can talk about that in a second. But since the market is jumping ship, that we're left basically with hoping we can get good billionaires to bankroll journalism as opposed to the bad billionaires like the Koch brothers and Shelley Adelson who don't want it. And the problem here is that if you think about it, such a fundamentally undemocratic way, basically the people of a country are reduced to rooting for billionaires, who are the legitimate citizens of the society, who legitimately control the society. And you just hope we have a good billionaire that wins. I mean, in a way, it's not too far from what existed 1,000 years ago in Europe, where you could root for a king or a count or a duke in their wars with another king or count or duke and hope you got a good royal family. But, you know, we had a revolution in 1776 in this country, and there were revolutions across the world ever since then to get away from that asinine and ridiculous approach to social life and politics, the anti-democratic nature of it. And we've got to come up with much better, much stronger solutions to the journalism crisis than hoping we just have a bunch of billionaires who are willing to bankroll it. And no matter how rich Pierre Amadiar is or Warren Buffett or whoever, whatever billionaire we're hoping for money from, they can't provide the resources to cover the type of journalism a free society needs, which is an enormous industry requiring, you know, tens of billions of dollars. And the money simply isn't there for that from private wealthy billionaires.
And the other thing that's interesting is there hasn't been that much scrutiny of Amadiar because he's backing someone like Glenn Greenwald.
That's right. And, you know, money comes with strings attached, no matter who provides it. A lot of these startups on the internet now, nonprofit news media, which are all basically desperate to survive, and they're all floundering. No one can make it, to be blunt. I'm an advisor to a lot of them, so I'm all too aware of the economics of digital journalism. But a lot of them are getting grants from funders, foundations, and they get them usually for a 3-year cycle till the money runs out, then they're desperately out of business. But these funders all have their own agenda. Foundations are not just writing a check and then turning around and going to the beach for 3 years. They have certain things they want done, and Amadiar will be no different. When he's signing $250 million, he's got an idea of the sort of stuff he wants. He knows that gives him immense power. And what Glenn and Jeremy and anyone who works with someone like that is always praying is, you know, hopefully they're just going to sort of space out, write the check, and go to the beach. And sometimes that will happen, but usually it doesn't happen. People who are worth $5, $10, $15, $20 billion are used to getting their way. They're not used to basically writing a check and then getting out of the way and letting someone do something with their money they didn't want done. And that, so it's ceding enormous amounts of power and praying for the benevolence of the new kings.
According to reports, Pierre Omidyar, the eBay founder, has a lot of development, or he's got a lot of investments in luxury hotels and resorts. He's a big landowner in Hawaii. The other thing that's interesting when you look at someone like Omidyar and then Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, is that a lot of the CEOs in Silicon Valley who are now delving into media ventures are pretty hardcore libertarians. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, libertarian is probably the most bogus word in American politics. It is so misused, misrepresented, and misidentified. It's become basically a code word for someone to make as much money as possible without paying taxes. And then since you're in favor of same-sex marriage and legalized pot, that makes you a cool person. And, you know, that is such a hackneyed notion of libertarianism. You know, Tom Frank, the author, had a great line. He wrote a book called The Wrecking Crew about 5 years ago on sort of the culture of the right wing in Washington, D.C. And he made the, I think, rather astute observation that, you know, there's the whole industry of very rich people in Washington, D.C. who live off the government, off of lobbying, who call themselves libertarians, but their entire industry is lobbying the government for tax breaks for corporations, yet they call themselves libertarians. You know, we have this enormous economy that's predicated on sucking at the tit of the government, being wrapped up with the government, that's being created by people who call themselves libertarians, people who wouldn't know libertarianism if they hit them in the butt. A genuine libertarian who really took their politics seriously would be against the military budget. They would be against all sorts of tax breaks for corporations, et cetera, et cetera. They'd be against monopolies. They'd be for breaking up the very companies where most of them make their fortunes. So the whole term libertarian is absurd. But the other point, Rose, and I think Jeff Bezos is a perfect example of this, even more than Amidyar. Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post for $250 million. And he got that really for the money he could take, quarters he could take out of his spare change jar next to his bed. He's worth, you know, $20, $30, $40 billion, depending on whatever the Amazon stock price is. But it's worth noting that if he tried to buy the Washington Post 10 or 12 years ago, he probably would have had to spend $5 or $6 billion. He got it for nothing. And he got it for nothing because Wall Street and the investment community and media corporations have all come to the clear, obvious conclusion that no one can make money doing journalism in an era in which advertising is no longer supporting journalism, as it is online. Digitally, advertising doesn't support journalism. So why did Bezos, he got it for a cheap amount, but why would he want to have the Washington Post? What was the interest if it's not really a smart commercial investment? Well, the answer is that the Washington Post, although it's not going to make any money, still has immense political power, and especially in Washington, D.C., where it really defines the political culture. And Jeff Bezos has huge political interests connected to Amazon and his Amazon empire, where he has very strong concerns with what the federal government does. The government will shape his existence. You know, Jeff Bezos is a monopoly, so he wants to make sure the government does not enforce its antitrust laws. Jeff Bezos hates labor unions because he depends on really low-wage labor working in onerous conditions at his warehouses around the country. Jeff Bezos hates paying taxes. He's like Shelley Adelson. Taxes are for the little people. He wants to minimize whatever tax bite he can pay. And Jeff Bezos wants Amazon to have a global empire. He wants the U.S. government to be his private army once you cross the borders of this country, blasting open markets and protecting them for Amazon monopoly. So owning the Washington Post may not make money for him, you know, in the near term. It may not make money per se at the Washington Post, but if he can have that to sort of give him leverage in all those debates in Washington, it will pay for itself 1,000 times over.
We're speaking with Robert McChesney, professor in the Department of Communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Bob is co-founder of the organization Free Press. He's led the battle against media consolidation. He's the author of many books. He and John Nichols co-authored Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Campaign is Destroying America. He's also author of Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. And I'm Rose Aguilar. It's our Friday Media Roundtable, and this is a pre-taped show, so unfortunately, we can't take any of your phone calls. You touch on this in your book, but what don't we get about the economics of journalism? Because Barbara Ehrenreich often talks about why the issue of poverty doesn't get covered much. And she says, you know, when you're reading a newspaper, most of the ads are for high-end readers, and this is not something that people want to read about, is poverty, to have like a high-end ad next to a story about poverty.
That's a good question, and it's got really several layers to give an accurate answer. And I think to start with the point Barbara Ehrenreich was making, over the past 50 years, as our society has become far more unequal, with huge increases in poverty and much more inegalitarian than it was, say, in the 1970s or 1960s. As that's taken place, our journalism has basically dropped any interest in poverty. It's dropped any interest in inequality. They're basically unreported stories. They were reported far more in the 1960s when, by contemporary standards, we were virtually a communist society in terms of equality, where we had the lowest level of poverty and inequality, rates of inequality, in America since before the Gilded Age, since the Industrial Revolution. But it's been blacked out as a news story. You know, the classic example of how it's been blacked out is how the entire prison industrial complex story is virtually a non-story in our news media, even though we have more people behind bars or in the prison system as a percentage of our population than any other country in world history. I mean, we're topping Stalin, we're topping South Africa, we're topping Pol Pot and Hitler. We're number one. We all know that if the people in our prison industrial complex, if the prisoners came from the top 10 or 20% of the population, this would be unquestionably the biggest news story ever. It would top World War II. I mean, if you were locking up 50% of the graduates of Harvard on drug offenses within a year of getting out of school, everyone would know about it. Their parents would make sure if they didn't. But since the population that stocks our prison is overwhelmingly non-white, overwhelmingly poor and working class, they drop from view, and that's the way our commercial news media work. Basically, they've been evolved over the last 30 years to be overwhelmingly concerned with the people who are considered in their market, and that doesn't include poor and working class people. So they simply are only of interest when they get in the way of rich people. And when they don't get in the way of rich people, their own concerns have absolutely no interest to journalists. That's unfortunately the way it goes. And that shouldn't be that way, obviously. Credible journalism in a democratic society would treat the concerns of all people equal. There wouldn't be, like, rich people and wealthy consumers. Their interests are the legitimate issues of interest of society, and the interests of poor people and hunger and poverty are simply non-issues unless they get in the way of rich people. Now, the second part of your question, which was where you started, is what's changed with the economics of journalism? And I think this is the point that I emphasize both in Dollarocracy with John Nichols and especially in Digital Disconnect. There has been a radical and fundamental change economically in journalism that's really destroying journalism as it's been understood. And it's only been in the last 3 or 4 years that it's crystallized. And what's happened is this. For the last 100 to 125 years, journalism in America was a very profitable undertaking. because you had huge companies that were able to make lots of money, usually with monopoly newspaper broadcasting franchises.
Bob, can you hold that thought? We're going to take a quick break. And then after the break, I'd love for you to tell stories about when journalism was profitable. We're speaking with Robert McChesney, professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He and John Nichols, the Washington, D.C. correspondent for The Nation, have co-authored a new book called Dollarocracy: How the Money and Media Election Campaign is Destroying America. Bob also authored Digital Disconnect: How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. And I'm Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation about the future of public employee pensions in California. We'll have a debate about the Pension Reform Act of 2014. This is a measure intended to allow cities to adjust their workers' retirement benefits in California. So where do you stand in this ongoing pension debate? That's on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. On today's show, we are spending the hour with longtime media reform advocate Robert McChesney. As co-founder of the organization Free Press, Bob has led the battle against media consolidation. He's the author of the book Digital Disconnect: How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. We'll be talking more about that a little later in the show. He also co-authored the book Dollarocracy: How the Money and Media Election Campaign is Destroying America. He co-authored it with John Nichols, the Washington, D.C. correspondent with The Nation. And over the past 7 weeks, they have done 45 events across the country. Bob is professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And this is a pre-taped show, so unfortunately, we can't take any of your phone calls. So, Bob, before the break, we were talking about how the economics of journalism have really drastically changed. And you were talking about when journalism was actually profitable. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. And we had commercial journalism in the United States prospered in the 20th century, and vast fortunes were made by huge companies, some of the wealthiest fortunes in the country, usually by newspaper monopolies or broadcast media chains. And the basis of this was advertising. Advertising provided between 50 or 60% at the low end, up to 100% at the high end of the revenues of our news media. Advertising was the basis for its commercial success. But advertisers only had an opportunistic relationship with journalism. They had to buy newspaper ads to accomplish their commercial ends, or magazine ads, or broadcast news ads. Now they're finding, and this is the radical change, as we go to the internet era, what's crystallized is that advertising no longer buys ads on a website to reach final consumers, so they're forced to support the content of the website if they want to get their final consumers. Instead, when advertisers now go online, they go to one of the four great advertising networks, Google, Microsoft, AOL, and they go to them and they say, we want to buy 10 million women, 25 to 29, who bought toothpaste in the last week and who will probably be interested in buying toothpaste next week or whatever the product might be. And the network will deliver those 10 million women in real time, right away, at whatever website they go to. Because as we know now from Snowden, they know everywhere you go. They know who you are. They know everything about you. They know what you buy. So they will find you. And what that means for journalism, and this is where it's crucial, is that the money that advertisers used to have to pay to websites or to news media to produce content to attract readers, they no longer have to do that anymore. Because these ads will go to the Best Buy website. They'll go to a basketball website. They'll go wherever people are It doesn't matter. And the ads will only appear to the on the computers or the smartphones or the tablets of those people who are in the target audience. No one else at the website will see that ad. And what this means is, for example, in 2003, when a newspaper had a website, it received 100% of the advertising on the newspaper's website, went to it. By 2010, it was only getting 20% of the revenues of the website from advertising. 80% were going to these networks that would place it. Today, I think the figure is probably under 10%, and like a parabola, it's approaching zero. That's why commercial journalism's dead. That's why the Washington Post only costs $250 million, mm-hmm. because without advertising, journalism has never been a profitable undertaking just based on final readers, final viewers. It has always depended upon advertising. And that's the dilemma we face right now. We're in an ad-free journalism going forward, and there's no commercially understandable way that you could make money doing that. It is not a profitable enterprise. And we're faced then, Rose, with the fundamental issue that John Nichols and I are pushing in our book, that I've done in my research. We've got to accept that journalism, if we're going to have it, is a public good. It's something society desperately needs, but the market will not produce in sufficient quality or quantity. And if we want to have it, it's a fundamental political issue of the first order.
You know, and it makes me kind of sad because I have so many freelance journalist friends who are asked to write articles for either $100 or for free. And I wonder, what do you think the public actually wants? Because the one thing I loved about your book, Digital Disconnect, is that you say, you know, half the country doesn't vote. And this whole idea of the country being polarized is really a media myth. How do we know that when half the country doesn't really vote and doesn't really have a voice, especially in the media? So based on all the research you've done over the years and the people that you have met, what do you think the public actually wants from the media?
You know, there's a lot of different ways to answer it. I think one of the problems we've had with answering that question is people try to say, well, let's look at market behavior. Let's see what people are watching, listening, doing with the existing array of choices and say that must be what people want because that's what they're consuming. And if they wanted something else, the market would give them something else. And the problem with that is that when you deal with public goods, and I would qualify journalism as a public good, the market is not an accurate reflector of taste at all. And I'll give you the example that I like to use is that, you know, I will never go to another national park again in my life. Ever, I promise. I make a vow on a Bible. And it's not that I don't like national parks. It's just that I'm 60 years old. I've been there. I've done that. And whatever free time I have left in my remaining years, I've got friends I'd like to see. I'd rather go to cities. There are just other places, things I'd rather do with my time. Now, if you look at my market behavior, you would say, well, Bob McChesney, he doesn't care about national parks. You know, sell them off, cut his taxes, get rid of them because he'd rather do something else with his time. He has no interest in supporting them. But in fact, I'm really interested in supporting national parks, expanding them. I'm really interested in expanding, our ecological commitment to repairing the environment. And I'm willing to pay for it, even though I won't be out there necessarily grooving in it. And that's where it's a public good. It's a public good because market doesn't reflect my values. As a citizen, I have very different values than what I do with my own time and how I spend my money. And that's what journalism is. The research that we've done shows that when people are asked about journalism, do you want someone covering the CIA, the government, the state house in your state, and its relationship with commercial interests? Do you think there should be reporters covering this? People across the political spectrum say, darn yeah, it's really crucial we have that. And what's interesting is they'll say that even if they don't intend to read it themselves, even if they don't intend to purchase the media that does it, they think it's crucial for our society that we have such people doing that work. Otherwise, they won't keep their freedom. And that's how I was with national parks. It's a public good. And when you understand it that way, you see the whole problem through a very different lens.
What about how the internet has really affected these issues? Because you write about this in your book. A lot of people argue that the digital revolution is really invigorating democracy because the internet creates a self-governing space that's not regulated by the state or the ruling class. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's certainly one of the great claims I talk about in Digital Disconnect, and there's an element of truth to it. There was a lot more element of truth to it in the 90s, maybe even as recently as a decade ago than there is today. But unquestionably, there's been tremendous benefits by the internet for the quality of our lives, for democracy, for information. But the problems are multifold. One I just mentioned, it's really not created a way for there to be resources going to journalism. So having access to countless pages of material after a Google search doesn't mean a whole lot if there's not someone actually reporting on something. There's not actually quality reporting being done or any type of reporting being done because no one can get paid to do it. So it hasn't solved the resource issue. In fact, it's exacerbated it dramatically. But there's even a more fundamental problem here, or equally fundamental problem, which is that when the Internet came along in the 1990s, the vision that the people who created it, the engineers and the scientists, they had of it was going to be an empowering technology where the power was with the user at the end side of the network. They could see whatever they wanted to see on whatever terms they wanted to see them, and they would control their environment. And we've seen over the last 20 years, and especially in the last 5 years, that's been turned on its head. The NSA scandal sort of made this clear now. No longer are we anonymous people who can see what we want to see online, and we sort of control our environment. But instead, today, we're completely known to commercial interests. They know more about us than we know about ourselves online. For example, when you delete material from Gmail or Google or Facebook, you can't see it again, but they still have it. They have it forever. You know, so you're basically just deleting what you have access to, not what they have access to. And they know everything about us. That's what we learned from the NSA scandal. And what's happening increasingly is they shape what you get on your screen, on your smartphone, on your tablet. It's no longer like we all see the same thing, but instead what we're getting is shaped by what commercial interests think we will be interested in. They create a filter bubble, as Eli Pariser calls it, for us. And so we're getting different worlds, all of us, oftentimes self-referencing. So if they know you're interested in something, you're going to get funneled that on the page of whatever site you go to. You get funneled advertising on there's things they think you're going to want to buy. And so it's built basically to be a commercial medium to maximize sales. It's not built to sort of open up this whole new vista of an exciting world where we're all equals and we're all exploring it in some sort of serendipitous hippie romp.
You also write about how in just a decade, these major, major tech companies have basically monopolized the Internet.
Yeah, and this is one of the key points of digital disconnect that really hasn't been appreciated sufficiently. And I think it's really going to be one of the defining issues of the next decade, politically and economically in America, because we are in a new Gilded Age. And the giants of our new Gilded Age, the modern Rockefellers, Goulds, Vanderbilts, and Carnegies, are the Silicon Valley tech lords, the Internet bosses. And what we, you know, the Internet, the great promise of it rose back in the 1990s was it was going to blast open capitalism and make it highly competitive. And it's going to open up the doors for small entrepreneurs, give consumers the power to get lower prices and better services. Everything was going to be sort of the greatest capitalism imaginable. And one of the great ironies of the last 10 years is that the Internet's become the greatest producer of monopoly in the history of any economy, not just capitalism. What we see everywhere we turn online is that the dominant players are all monopolies. There's a handful of huge giants that control pretty much everything. There's no middle class. There's no sort of mid-level firms that have survived, really. They've been wiped out like the plague. And then you've got a lot of young startups that hope to either basically to be bought out by one of the giants and get a fortune on prospective sales. And these giant companies, the monopolists, are well known to people in the Bay Area because a lot of them are in Silicon Valley, like Google and like Apple. But a lot of them are Amazon, Microsoft, and there's Facebook, of course, eBay. There's a handful of them, so that 13 of the 30 most valuable companies in the American economy today are basically Internet monopolies. Mm-hmm. And by monopoly, I mean the term not in the sense that one company has 100% of market share. There's almost never that in any capitalist market. The way economists have traditionally used the term monopolies, I mean, a company has enough market share, usually 50, 60, 70% at least, that they can control the market. They can set the price, and they can determine how much competition they want. Rarely is it worth it to get 100% of a market because you have to lower your price such that it hurts your profitability. You pick the market share that gives you max profits, and the surviving companies that are in the market know that basically they take what price they charge from you, what they do. So most of those Internet monopolies, Google, Apple, Amazon, they have market dominance in their core areas that are equal to or greater than what John D. Rockefeller had with Standard Oil at the peak of his empire in the late 19th century. So they're huge monopolies. And much of the reason they're monopolistic is because of network effects. What we've learned from the Internet is that if you're number one in an industry, everyone has incentive to go to you because of the way networks work, and it's almost impossible for anyone else to survive. So, for example, if I'm going to do social media, I can go to Facebook with a billion other people, or I can go to MySpace with nine other people. Well, I'm probably going to go to Facebook. I don't want to talk to other people. That's the rational place to go. So this is the new world we have. We have, you know, 10 or 12 enormous monopolies, each of which are competing now with each other in a lot of different areas. So if there's Google Plus is trying to get a chunk of the Facebook market, and they're all trying to get a chunk of the tablet market, the chunk of the online retail. But they're the only ones who can play. There's no one else in the game. It's those 12 guys basically control the board. And 12 is a liberal term. It's really less than that for the most part, depending on the sector. It's from 4, 5, 6 at most. And it's turned capitalism on its head. And it means that the vast wealth of the Internet that it's produced for the economy has been funneled into a very small number of hands. And the economic benefits of the Internet are far less than they might have been otherwise.
We're speaking with Robert McChesney, professor in the Department of Communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Bob is co-founder of the organization Free Press, longtime media reform advocate who has led the battle against media consolidation. His latest book is Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. He and John Nichols, the Washington D correspondent for The Nation, have co-authored another book called Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Campaign is Destroying America. And this is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately we can't take any of your phone calls. Bob, in your book, Digital Disconnect, you also point out that capitalism is based on CEOs trying to make endless profits by any means possible. So what mechanisms are in place to reform the media to prevent total privatization of traditional and online media as we're seeing now?
Well, historically, if you look throughout the history of capitalism, there have been great reform movements which have in effect tried to lessen the power of the wealthy few and increase the power of the many. The trade union movement has done that. Public education has done that. Creating programs like Social Security and Medicare have done that, or in other European countries, single-payer health insurance. Another mechanism is to reduce inequality. Progressive taxation has been a crucial factor. And all those issues, approaches, are certainly in play today. But what the Internet does, and this gets to your question, is it sort of introduces, it sort of raises the stakes, sort of, because we have now tremendous economic inequality in the United States, such that, if the way sociologists and economists measure economic inequality in countries is something called the Gini Index. And the United States has a Gini Index score showing economic inequality today that's closer to the Philippines or Malaysia than it is to Western Europe or East Asia, Japan or Korea. We've become a hugely inegalitarian country. And so the question is, how do we address that in an economy where the dominant players now are highly monopolistic and the money's being funneled in the way you talk about, the people like Mark Zuckerberg or Bill Gates or whatever the executive might be at Google, where they're making vast fortunes. And there are some people getting very rich, but most people aren't getting dealt in at all, despite the importance of the Internet. How do we face that? And I think there's really two sets of issues here. One is with what I call the Internet cartel. These are the companies, basically AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast, that control Internet access, both cell phones and wireline Internet. And I call them the cartel because these companies have more or less divided up the market. They control whether you get access to the Internet in the United States on a cell phone, a tablet, or a computer through a line or wireless. And they don't compete with each other. They more or less divided up the market. And it's a classic cartel in the sense that we pay more than any other country in the world for much worse service because they have no incentive to invest, and they can get away with ripping us off with higher prices. And the reason it's a cartel, too, is that these are not free market companies. These are not companies that won their spurs in the marketplace and they became more efficient and more effective, and that's why they won. These are all government-created monopolies. They all have monopoly licenses historically that gave them the power to have this power, monopoly influence, and they own the politicians. I mean, basically, what their competitive advantage is that they have the best lobbying armies in Washington and state capitals. As the head of Free Press said to me recently, said, the only difference really when it comes to Internet access and in policy making is when the Republicans or Democrats are in power is whether AT&T overtly or covertly writes the rules, because they have that much influence no matter who's in power. So the cartel, which doesn't really exist in other countries. It's either much better regulated or there's some mechanism to prevent that sort of private power and that corruption. I think we should just nationalize that. We should just have internet access. It should be a public right. It should be free. Mm-hmm. We should pay these companies for their wires and wish them a good day and then tell them to get lost and stop corrupting our system. And I'd make internet access basically free for everyone. I'd make it a public good and get rid of all the barbed wire all over the internet. But there's no justification for the system we have there with those, the cartel. They're basically, when people come from other countries, they're just astounded that the crappy service and the high prices we pay in this country. It's all due to political corruption. And all those libertarians you asked me about earlier, Rose, they're all bagmen for these companies. They're libertarians, but not when they're getting a paycheck from AT&T, Verizon, or Comcast. Then suddenly they're the most corrupt crony capitalists you've ever seen. So that's what you do with those guys. As for the sort of the natural monopoly giants of network capitalism, Google, Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, Facebook, eBay, who sort of have these monopolistic markets, I think that's a really fundamental question we're going to have to face once we get off the cheerleading and hero worshiping that we've been doing in our news media and in our culture towards these companies. Because, you know, Milton Friedman, the great conservative economist, his mentor at the University of Chicago, who was a conservative free market economist, made a very telling point. He said that when companies get so big, they're natural monopolies, that they dominate the economy and they suck up profits and they have inordinate influence over the politics of a nation, for a free market entrepreneur capitalist, or someone who believes in free market capitalism, there's a strong case that has to be made if you can't break those companies into much smaller parts so they become competitive, that they should be nationalized and run by the government, because otherwise they'll destroy competitive capitalism because they're going to have so much power in the market, so much power politically. And I think that's coming from a conservative free market capitalist perspective. I'm not that, but I think it makes perfect sense. I think that's the debate we need to be having. Can we afford to have these sort of monopolies running our economy? They're almost entirely unaccounted for. I think the answer is ultimately going to be no. And then the question is, what next?
The Economist recently had a piece about eBay's founder, Pierre Omidyar, who, again, is going to back Glenn Greenwald's new news venture with $250 million in capital. And this is what The Economist said, quote, "His experience at eBay led him to conclude that in the right circumstances, a business can be at least as powerful a force for good as a charity. By creating a readily accessible global marketplace, eBay had given hundreds of thousands of people the chance to improve their lives by becoming online entrepreneurs," end quote. So what are your thoughts on that, Bob? Again, we're talking about the good billionaire here.
I think that the system has such a powerful logic that the values and interests of an individual owner really become irrelevant. I mean, the people who started Google, for example, and the people who started Apple were largely sort of hippies. Neither company was started by people who wanted to be capitalists. You know, we look at their discussions, and they had deep concerns about whether they should even be for-profit companies. But, you know, over time, once you get in the game and you start competing as a business, you either play by the rules of the game or you get crushed. And so now, you know, these are companies that don't like labor unions, they don't like paying taxes, they don't like regulations. You know, they are traditional businesses. They adopt the sort of values you would expect traditional businesses. And I think that's always going to be the case. So we shouldn't have any illusions that someone's values as a CEO, if they're are going to be different, they're going to adopt the values of their institution. That's the historical record. So I think that should be a concern. The other issue is there's no question that companies provide services of value, or else they wouldn't have any customers. So eBay provides a service of value. Google does. Apple does. Amazon does. The question is whether these companies should be monopolies where the fruits and the control of a fundamental institution of great public need are controlled by one company that gets all the profits and that controls the nature of the system. That's a completely separate question. Whether society benefits by having one company, eBay, rake in a gazillion dollars because they have a monopoly network franchise is the right way to do it is a different question. Whether we need something like an eBay service that provides a service to people. I think the answer to the second one is obviously yes. To the first one, I think the answer is, in my view, no, but it's certainly what we should be debating.
So what is the way forward? I mean, given the realities that we are facing right now, how would you reform the media?
In the book, both Digital Disconnect in particular, but also Dollarocracy, The argument we make, that I make and that John and I make in one of the books, is that for solving the journalism crisis, we've got to have it as a public policy decision. That's first and foremost where it's got to go. We've got to understand that in those countries that are ranked the most democratic in the world by The Economist magazine, by Freedom House, by basically conservative groups that just look at the countries of the world, the countries that rank it as the most democratic in the world year after year after year, including in 2013, are the countries that spend the most supporting public media and community media. They have the largest per capita spending to support nonprofit and non-commercial media and journalism. And we're way down both lists. We hardly spend anything to support community and public media or nonprofit, non-commercial journalism. So I think that, to me, is the first lesson. We've got to get in the game. If we're serious about being a democracy, we've got to make a real commitment of public funds to support independent, competitive, nonprofit, non-commercial newsrooms and media. And the debate's got to be how best and how most effectively to spend that money to prevent corruption, to prevent any malfeasance. That's where we should be. That's the serious discussion other democracies have been having, and that's the discussion we're going to have very soon in this country. And I think a lot flows through that, because until we get real journalism, competing independent newsrooms covering stuff, almost every other issue is going to be very difficult to resolve. So I think that's got to be the starting point, and in the mix of any program to address the internet and to address social problems of our times. At the same time, I think we've got to think big. This is a moment in which sort of piddly minor changes, like just debating over whether the cap for television station ownership should be 45% or 39%. That's not the way to think about the crises of our times and the issues we're at, the issues we face. I think we should be talking about what I said before. And do we even need this cartel? We know they're rich. We know they own the politicians. But we also know they really don't serve the public good. They're fleecing us and making a killing doing it. Maybe we ought to be discussing whether they should even exist, because they're all based on government-created licenses. It's like, they're just purely corrupt. So I think we've got to have big, bold ideas and debate them and talk about them, and understand that, we need fundamental change here if we're really going to have something remotely close to democracy, and not just be a dollarocracy where we root for our favorite billionaire and hope he's a good guy.
We have listeners who are pretty hardcore media junkies and obviously care about these issues. What can people do about this issue?
Well, I think the most important thing you can do is, first of all, listen to shows like this, support stations like this. And I don't say that in passing. I think that's absolutely important. Support the shows like this that cover these issues. Have a conversation like this that you will not hear in commercial media. It's simply not going to happen. I think also then it's important to get politically engaged. The group that Nichols and I helped start, Free Press, is a public interest group that monitors these issues, that works on them. Now, they don't take the exact same positions I take on these issues. I'm a college professor. I'm allowed to sort of say whatever I want. They're a political organization, and so, but they're concerned with public interest involvement in all the issues I've talked about. I'd urge people to go to freepress.net. Get involved with the group, follow them, work with them. They've been very effective on NSA spying. They've been the leaders of the campaign to eliminate spying on individuals by the government. They've been ahead of the curve on network neutrality, prohibiting the cartel from censoring what we can do online, and a host of other crucial issues that are mandatory for a free society. And then the third issue I would say is that people who are engaged politically, get your politicians to talk about this. Get your local organizations to talk about this, and not just the ones you like, but if you've got a member of Congress who you don't support, you should bug them on this. Let them know you care about this issue, because until politicians, candidates hear from their constituents that this is important, they're going to keep ignoring it and just listen to what the people who pay the bills want to talk about, which is tax breaks for them and deregulation for them.
Bob McChesney is professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Bob, thanks so much for joining us.
My great pleasure, Rose.
And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Is internet vigilantism justified when governments fail to uphold the law? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about the online activist group Anonymous and the power of online dissent. Two rape cases were reopened after Anonymous brought media attention and exposure to the perpetrators. Anonymous is also responding to increasing state and corporate surveillance. So what tactics are acceptable, and how are governments responding to civil disobedience online? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.